things that were corrupt in church doctrine and practice, and stated that they were unscriptural. They were, in fact, contrary to Scripture. And he was prepared to debate that with anybody. Now, that was the point where the Reformation really got underway. Now, Martin Luther did not intend to start a separate Protestant church. He was a Catholic priest, and all he wanted was to clean up the things in his own church that he found shouldn't be there. And he intended to save all that part which was good, and he had no idea of cutting himself off from it. Well, there was all the usual church strategy. He was excommunicated. He was summoned to attend a great gathering, a diet at the city of Worms. He was outlawed. Any man encouraged to kill him with no penalty. But he went there. Now, he was given the safe conduct promise. He could go and return to his own home, but there was the intention to treacherously capture him and murder him. But by this time, his doctrines had spread to some pretty influential places. He came there. He refused to recant. He defended his doctrine, showed where they were sound according to the Bible, and he just planted himself. He said, "Here I stand. God helping me, I can do no other." He wouldn't yield one inch. Well, Prince Frederick of Saxony knew of the plot to arrest and murder him, so he had some of his troops kidnap Martin Luther and rush him out to safety, and for a bit over a year, he hid Luther in his own castle where Luther continued his writings. And finally, after a bit more than a year, it was safe to let Luther out again. And Lutheranism spread very rapidly through Germany and Scandinavia from then on. Now, the church having refused to clean up any of this thing, the people who saw that these things were contrary to the Bible had no choice left to them but to leave the church and organize their own church, which would not have these doctrinal errors. Now, as I say, that is not what Martin Luther started out trying to do. He wanted the church to clean up its own mistakes and to keep all its people. But it was not so to be. In France, Protestantism filtered into France, 1520 to 1523 A.D., largely Wycliffe's writings, although Martin Luther's also became very well known there. It spread rapidly. By 1561, over 2,000 churches in France sent representatives to a great synod or gathering of representatives of the Protestant churches there. And it was, by the way, in France that the name Protestant was coined. At one of their bitter controversies with the Catholic Church hierarchy, they were promised that they might conduct their own worship without interference. And this was official. The official resolution settling the matter, and a matter of just a few weeks later, the church declared that promise was void. They weren't going to stand by it. And the Huguenots, the French Protestants, protested against that breach of faith, and from that they got their name as Protestants. Now, the conditions in France were peculiarly bad. You had two families constantly conducting civil war for the crown. At that time, the House of Valois included the king on the throne. And since a large part of the population of France, probably 30-40%, seemed to be Protestant, they wanted the support of the Protestants because the rival family, the Guise family, were very strong Catholics and had the support of the Pope. So In the Civil War, the Valois family were constantly seeking the support of the Protestants and promising them as a reward that they would be permitted to worship undisturbed. That's all the Huguenots asked. And as fast as the king got past a crisis through the military help of the Huguenots and found things steady again, why, he would then go back on his promise. Well, there were some 8 of these different civil wars in which the Huguenots participated under promise of being allowed to worship in peace. Each one repudiated. In 1570, King Charles IX signed an official treaty granting toleration to the Huguenots. He was married to a daughter of Catherine de' Medici. Now, you remember there were 2 Italian Jewish families who furnished popes. One was the de' Medicis and the other the Borgias, and they were both infamous, you remember, both families as being assassins, murdering by poison. The de' Medicis were also, as is consistent with their race, moneylenders, usurers. The pawnbroker's emblem of the 3 golden balls was the coat of arms of the de' Medici family. Well, Catherine de' Medici, who of course was very much on the side of the Catholics because she wanted more de' Medicis to become popes in due time, she was the mother of the Queen of France. Catherine de' Medici and the king plotted a treacherous massacre of the Protestants. And so on the evening before St. Bartholomew's Day, August 4th, 1572, the word had been sent out. The king sent out to his army, and through the churches, the priests had sent word to all the members of the Catholic churches that night there was to be a wholesale massacre, an attempt to entirely exterminate all the Protestants of France. My own ancestors were among the survivors of that, or I wouldn't be here. Suddenly, without warning, around midnight, the church bell started tolling, and then, see, the members of the Catholic congregation, as I say, they are not personally blameworthy to the extent of the church hierarchy, because these people never had been told anything different. They were told that the most praiseworthy thing they could do for their church was to go out and murder a heretic, man, woman, or child. And they were officially promised indulgences for their sins. If you murdered a heretic child, age 4, why, you could go out and commit a few rapes or that sort of thing, and you had the pardon of the church granted in advance. So, you had these people in the frenzy stirred up, and with some of the king's troops participating, and they burst into the houses of the Protestants, caught the people in their houses just starting up out of sleep, and they murdered men, women, and children indiscriminately. Any house they got into, no survivor was left alive. And it was a frightful slaughter. The Pope issued a medal commemorating the massacre of St. Bartholomew's Eve as a great triumph for the church. Well, these civil wars were still going on. The Valois family failed to produce an heir to the throne, and the Navarre family became the ones contesting the throne with the Guise family. And by Huguenot help in the 8th of these civil wars, Henry of Navarre gained the throne of France. And he issued the Edict of Nantes, which gave Huguenots complete religious freedom. However, he changed his own religion. He had claimed to be Protestant up to that time, and he changed his religion to Catholicism so that he wouldn't have friction with the opposition faction. And then October 8, 1685, treacherously, without warning, he revoked this edict and sent his troops out to murder the Huguenots. Well, this completed the slaughter of considerably over half of all the Huguenots in France, and such as survived fled into other countries, so that for a long time, you might say up until the French Revolution, Catholicism was supreme in France, and the Reformation had no further foothold. In England, the Reformation came about, as I say, as a financial and political matter. King Henry VIII was greatly disturbed at the amount of money that the church in England was collecting from its people and sending to the Pope as tribute. Also, he was married to Catherine of Aragon, of the Spanish royal family, and she had borne him four daughters but no son. And he could see where, on his death, there would be civil war to take over the throne, and his family were going to be left out in the cold. And he wanted to divorce Catherine of Aragon and marry another queen and see if he couldn't get a son to succeed him on the throne. As a matter of fact, he went through that process six times, all told. Well, the Pope would not grant him a divorce. So they were completely at loggerheads. Henry married Anne Boleyn and had the Archbishop of Canterbury grant him a divorce from Catherine of Aragon. That was 1533. The Pope excommunicated Henry VIII, and Henry, in reply, had Parliament pass a law appointing the King the supreme head of the Church in England. Also laws cutting off all revenue from England going to the Pope. Now, that is the beginning of the Protestant Reformation in England, and you note that there isn't a bit of religious principle involved in it at all. Henry VIII had everything he wanted. He got Parliament to pass laws making it heresy, punishable by death, to dispute any of the major doctrines of the Catholic Church. And as a matter of fact, Henry VIII had a number of Lutherans burned at the stake. Now, we Protestants are proud of the fact that our Protestant religion began as a matter of principle on religion, but not in England. That was Martin Luther. That was not Henry VIII. Well, upon his death, he did get a son by one of the other queens, and Edward VI, his son, on the death of Henry in 1547, had these laws against Protestantism repealed, and laws favorable to the Protestant worship passed. On his death, in 1553, Bloody Mary came to the throne. She was the daughter of Henry VIII by Catherine of Aragon. Very strong in her Catholic faith herself, and she married King Philip of Spain, which also pushed the thing farther, because the Spaniards particularly were all for murdering all heretics. So she became Queen of England. She conducted terrific persecutions against the Protestants, burning large numbers of them at the stake, and a great many more fled to the continent of Europe for their lives. And for that persecution, she was called Bloody Mary. Now, over in Ireland, it's kind of hard for us to understand the bitter battle going on between the Irish Protestants and the Irish Catholics, because here in this country, we haven't had religious persecution like that. But if you remember that some of your ancestors were burned at the stake for their religious views, and if you remember that succeeding popes since then have also declared officially it is the policy of the church to use violence whenever it seems appropriate, you aren't too keen about seeing that group come into power again as perhaps the next step to going back to the burning of heretics at the stake. Now, the Irish have had a bad time of it. No country ever suffered under worse misrule than the Irish under their English conquerors. And the fact that the hated English, with their bad behavior, were also trying to destroy the Catholic Church in Ireland and set up a Protestant church, did nothing to give the Protestant church any better standing in the eyes of the Irish. It was just part of the oppression against them. And that is why you note that the Southern Irish are perhaps the most strongly Catholic people in the world today, and the Protestants are among those in the northern counties who are actually Scotch settlers there rather than originally Irish. Queen Elizabeth I came to the throne in 1558, and she immediately restored Protestantism, and having a Protestant majority in Parliament, she got through laws which established the present Church of England. So basically, that is what was happening during this period. You have the few people within the Catholic Church trying in vain to bring about reform. And you have the hierarchy holding the power in the church, not budging an inch on it, until finally all those who wanted to clean up the mess were compelled to leave. Now, you are sometimes told that the Catholic Church cleaned things up after that with their Counter-Reformation. It might be interesting to know what this consisted of. With the loss of millions of people going over to Protestantism, the reaction of the Catholic hierarchy was entirely one of fear and rage. They summoned a council at Trent in 1545 to settle all these disputes of doctrine. The council continued meeting with intermissions from 1545 until 1563. Now, all these points that had been disputed were brought up, and they didn't yield on any of them. They reaffirmed them. Sacred tradition was as authoritative as the Bible, and nothing that was traditional with the church could be questioned on the ground that the Bible was contrary to it. All the books in the Vulgate, the Latin translation of the Bible, were canonical, and the Vulgate itself was authoritative. The worship of saints, the doctrine of purgatory, which is contrary to the Bible, the sale of indulgences, all these were affirmed. The Lutheran doctrine that salvation is obtained not by payment of money to the church, but by faith in Jesus Christ, was condemned as heretical. And finally, the official resolution, all heretics were to be exterminated. Well, during the period from the solidification of power in the papacy in 604 A.D. down to the point where the Protestants finally broke away from them, the estimates of the number of people murdered by the Catholic Church, about 900 years in there, have varied from a low of 40 million people to as high as 60 million people. There are no official records kept of just how many were killed each time. You simply have to judge by the writings of the historians of that period, making the best estimate they can. And if you assume that these estimates were all too high and it never was more than 30 million people, that still is at least 20 or 30 times more than all the massacre of Christians by all the pagans in all history, not only the pagan Roman Empire, but those who were massacred by the Saracens and the Turks in the Eastern Church. So the most frightful persecution of Christianity that ever occurred in history was that which went on under the papacy in this period. And as I say, I don't want you to assume that this is a condemnation of the people in their congregations who had no authority to do anything, who, if they ventured to question this, were told, you're on your way to hell for heresy if you don't give up this. And all they knew was that they had been taught from infancy that the priest had the authority to send them to hell if he so chose. So they went along, ignorant, terrified. But upon the shoulders of the hierarchy, the priests and bishops and cardinals and pope, all of whom knew better, rests the most terrible responsibility that any man will ever face on Judgment Day. You notice that in this message to the church at Sardis, Jesus Christ, speaking of himself at the start, "These things saith he that hath the seven spirits of God and the seven stars." In other words, I am the one who has the authority to determine what is true, and not any man, priest or pope, though he be. This is a hot day, and I've kept you quite a long time here. I think we'd better break off at this point before we start on the remaining two of these churches, and we'll go into those next time.